Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Soo-yeon Kim, who's Associate Professor of Korean Studies at the University of Hong Kong, and she'll be talking about her new book, Imperial Romance, Fictions of Colonial Intimacy in Korea, 1905 to 1945, which was published last year, 2020, by Cornell University Press. Korean experiences of Japanese empire, like those of colonized people in many different places and times, were complicated tangles of relationships running in many different directions, from exploitation and suppression to collaboration and resistance. Perhaps even indifference may have been possible at times, when the imperial state didn't force its way into every corner of personal life, but as Soo-yeon Kim demonstrates in Imperial Romance, there was certainly no shortage of attempts from the Japan-backed authorities in Korea to shape more intimate aspects of Korean life. Managing relations with the Japanese was foremost among these, and the authorities went as far as promoting intermarriage between colonizer and colonized peoples. The official messaging was accompanied by cultural output from films to short stories and novels, which focused on Korean-Japanese romance, and intriguingly, quite a number of Korean writers were among the authors of the latter. While some of their works stick relatively closely to the imperial script regarding idealized Korean-Japanese unions, most of them also reflect, wittingly or unwittingly, the political, ethnic, linguistic, and of course also affective complexities of romantic relations in an imperial setting. As Soo-yeon Kim shows by placing the works of several prominent authors alongside official documents and media from the time, all of this offers an intriguing window into a lesser-studied dimension of empire at the interpersonal level, shedding light on questions of identity, domination, and sentiment amid a colonial history which remains fraught to this day. It's therefore a great pleasure to have the author here to tell us more, so I'll say Soo-yeon Kim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for a great introduction.
Well, yes, it's only a fraction of what's in the book, but I hope we'll be getting into a lot more detail as we talk. Before we do, though, perhaps I'll begin by asking you something of your own sort of academic background and how you became interested in the topic of Korean experience under Japanese Empire and its, you know, representations and so on.
Right. Okay, so currently I'm teaching at the University of Hong Kong in Korean Studies Department. Well, it's a Korean Studies program in School of Modern Languages and Cultures. But my specialty, so I would say my specialty is modern literature and culture and colonialism and imperialism, gender, sexuality, race. But recently, maybe I can talk it later more. Recently, I've been doing research more on the Cold War era and more popular literature in Korea. Mm-hmm. So basically that I kind of consider myself as a literature scholar, but with a spectrum that leans to culture studies. That's sort of, that comes from my background of training. So I actually did MA in French literature in Korea and also MA in Korea, but then comparative literature. Mm-hmm. Then I moved to University of California, San Diego in the US to pursue my PhD. So in this kind of rare program called Department of Literature. So it was combination of cultural studies, comparative literature, American studies. And there, I think I developed more sense of cultural studies perspective way of looking at literature work, actually. So I had the kind of seminars and training in history, Asian histories, Japanese history, Korean history, but also with theoretical training in cultural studies theories, post-colonialism, feminism, and whatnot. So I think that my project sort of came into a being when I was interested. I started my project, I guess my PhD project, more interested in looking at contemporary South Korean nationalism. But as I learned, kind of studied more of like 20th century, early 20th century and colonialism, and then I found this kind of material about Naesan Ilche, so Naesan Itai, and the colonial assimilation, and also this kind of writings about intermarriage, that sort of I developed a new project there. So my literature, some sort of Korean literature training, actually comes from a lot from individual advising and then my research year in Korea, where I studied at the Korean literature department, like taking seminars and joining like various study groups in Korea. And also I did some study groups in Japan. I think because of my background, I'm not from straightforward East Asian department or East Asian studies department or Korean literature department. So that's my project sort of brings in more different perspective and sort of the perspective that if you're coming from straight out like Korean literature training, you kind of tend to not see this kind of perspective. So I feel like I bring in more conversation on the table for Korean literature perspective, Korean literature scholars, and then also from broader culture studies, global imperialism or imperialism, colonialism studies, that I bring sort of different material. So,
yeah, for sure. Well, I think that becomes very obvious, you know, throughout the book with your use of a variety of different source materials, you know, not just purely the literary works, but also some of the historical documents that we'll get onto discussing. But I'm just curious, I mean, you mentioned there how you started out with a perspective on contemporary nationalism, or at least an interest in that, and then sort of went back to the Korean literature and the kind of authors that feature in this book. How aware were you, I mean, you know, having grown up, I guess I'm curious, given that you also placed some of this history into contemporary perspective, how much are ideas like, this Naesan Ilche, this idea of Korean-Japanese oneness during the imperial period, and how much are the authors that you draw on actually people that Korean people know about today, you know, from the nationalist lens, from the post-colonial lens? What was all of the material that came into this, your PhD and then the book, completely new to you? Or had you heard about some of it sort of before, anecdotally or growing up or anything like that?
Right. So I think because my earlier project, I was thinking about the contemporary South Korean nationalism in the frame of looking at the culture production and then knowledge production. So in that sense, I'm still looking at the knowledge production of the colonial period. But then how much I was aware of this kind of intimate relationship in the colonial period, I think it was very limited before I start doing research. So I think there's a kind of two dimension here. I think one is a public discourse, public or popular discourse of how in South Korea people remember Japanese colonialism. And I think also from the 90s, when I was in the university student, that was the time, I think, even the public discourse, public like cultural films or TV dramas brought in more different nuanced perspective of the colonial period, whereas mm-hmm. like previously, like you'd only kind of see like Japan, colonial Japanese period as dark period, oppressive and violent, mm-hmm. And the emphasis on all these atrocities. But then actually from the 90s, because of probably post-colonial discourse, and then because of like various global kind of movement and then exchange and connections, even popular product, popular culture start emphasizing on the modernization, urban modernity, or modern girl, modern boy. And actually that was the colonial period, was like the time that women start going to school. So women's education was more available than before. So these kind of things were appearing. But at the same time that the 90s, that was the part where the comfort woman issue start to coming out. And as the university student, I was also part of like comfort woman protests and, you know, like a student kind of activism stuff. So I was aware of that it was different. There's like different stories. It's not just mainstream oppressor and oppressed mm-hmm. kind of narrative of the colonial period. But the mm-hmm. academic discourse, I think, is different. It's a different set. So there I think academia research, they were aware of the certain intimacy or certain kind of modernization process in the colonial period, but then still the mainstream academia was emphasizing on the oppressor and then oppressed, or the like Chinil discourse, like who are the pro-Japanese collaborators. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. so the writers that I'm actually using in my books are these well-known writers in my youth, like from either by Korean public education or in the college, university, in like my own readings, that there are major writers that I know their major works, and then I read their major works, that's, you know, like kind of common readings. But then there are some, the writings that I use are not so well known to the public. Mm. And in the academia, maybe if you're Korean literature majors, like maybe you like read it or hear it in the lectures, scholars study them a little bit, but they're very limited. And then for the Japanese language novels or short stories were getting more attention or getting translated into Korean only from the 90s. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of frontier of Korean Korean literature or Korean history research, that this kind of, there was this multilingual dimension. It's not just monolingual Korean literature production, but there were people writing in Japanese, and then that could be part of the Korean literature.
Right. Yeah, I think kind of uncovering things that are somewhat known but offering a new dimension is exactly, as you said, one of the really fascinating things about this book. You know, we're aware that there was an empire. We were aware that there were the atrocities and the oppression that you mm-hmm. mentioned. And these authors are, somewhat known to people, but there are sides to their work that are unknown, and there are sides, just as there are sides to the imperial project, which have not been kind of explored in great detail. I mean, we've already kind of stepped into some of the contents right. of how you set up the book, so we may as well delve a bit further into how you set up the project in the introduction here, because you've mentioned already something of how, you know, the perspective, you know, as you were becoming aware of it, I guess, was changing on the Japanese colonial past from a Korean angle, and a kind of more nuanced or layered interpretations and representations of it were occurring, you know, from the, as you've said, I think from the 90s. So I guess the question then is, why is it that, you know, sort of change happened when it did? Why is it that intimate relationships under Japanese colonization, which you cover, been why have they been covered up so much, and what is it that has brought about that reinterpretation as you see it?
So the public, I guess, like a public memory kind of things, if it gets too intimate, I think it still remains in the uncomfortable territory for the public. So that I talk about this Lee Jung-sup, the painter's exhibition in 2016. That's pretty recent. Even recently that, when there's a talk about, there's Korean-Japanese marriage, intermarriage, and then there were children, mixed children, this kind of thing about like a public figures, I think is still a little bit, people are reluctant to accept in South Korea. Mm-hmm. But then in academia, I think why this kind of intimate relationship were not covered or not studied in the academia, I think it is various things, but then there's a definitely disciplinary limit, I think, how to approach this. So there are historians looking at the Daesonite or like a policies or legal changes, and the literature people looking at some fiction, some novels. But then I think people were reluctant to look at the whole, the together, like the connected way of things at the time. So that's in the 90s. Yeah, like I said, in the 90s, it was slowly coming out, revealing this like this intricate connectedness in the colonial era, that intimacy and the intimate relationships were part of the very important management point for the Japanese colonialism. So when you study history, like you cannot ignore this kind of marriage and the sexual relationship and cohabitation and the romance and all these things. So it's also, I think, the gender studies aspect of it was not so supported in the past. So I think I emphasized in the book many times, it's a combination of things, and there, because of the intricate nature and the disconnectedness, that if you sort of categorize it as like one thing, just like, it's just, very little number of intermarried people, because statistically it doesn't match the reality, but then statistically if you look at the archival numbers or the Korean the Japanese colonial government's the white book, like white papers kind of numbers, that it looks like just small population who the Korean and the Japanese intermarried couples. But so you kind of like pass it and ignore it for a long time. I think that was the one of the issues that people, general historians or like people generally thought like, there was a like small number of exception. But then I think in the 90s, as you look at more and more, then you see that it was actually a big phenomenon, that the writers were aware of it, and the Korean elites, especially men, they really seized the opportunity to have this kind of intermarriage discourse as part of Korean men's to sort of emphasize their equality to as a Japanese, and then raise their status in this like imperial hierarchy.
Right. So it sort of speaks of something a lot bigger, even if statistically, we can look at the raw figures and suggest that it was or at least understand how it's been seen as a marginal phenomenon in a Korean context. But of course, as you, I think, explained very well, it sort of represents something a lot more significant about the overall project and about the response to it. I guess another development that you draw attention to as far as perspectives on these aspects of empire is concerned are broader, changes in, academia, not just in a Korean context, but more globally, how empire has come to be understood from a, more nuanced, intimate or affective and gendered perspective too. So Could you say something about how the Japanese approach, the Japanese imperial approach to the intimate Korean-Japanese relationships compared to those that, you know, we can see in other kind of global contexts in various European empires, you know, British or Dutch or French or anything else, as well as other sort of imperial experiences. What did you see to be the useful points of comparison and difference between Japan and other imperial sort of formations?
Right. So in the beginning, I think I initially thought that Japan was an anomaly, and you know, about this kind of promoting intermarriage between colonizer and colonized subjects. But it turns out it's actually really part of the greater global imperial discourse, imperialism. So even the European and the American US imperialism, on the surface, like if you remember, like the 20th century early 20th century, mid 20th century, that there were like anti-misogynist law, and then like marriage, like were banned between, you know, like white and color, like this kind of division existed. But then as I looked at previous research, is more there's definitely this the movement of imperialism, development of imperialism had this managing point of like the intimate relationship and the sexual relationship were always part of the management points. So they were promoted actually, like, or a lot, let's say, like they were allowed in the beginning, I guess the beginning of the imperial kind of rule, colonial rule, in Asia, Southeast Asia or Africa or Americas. But then when it comes to in the consequences, when they see that the mixed children are coming back to the metropole, like European centers or the Americas, that in the US, then you need to tighten up the borders, tighten up the boundary of the citizenship, and then what makes European, white European, the European, or the white American, the white Americans, white US, US Americans. So it's actually there were times that they were always, the imperialisms, global imperialisms, were always managing the intimate and sexual relationship. So this could be, you know, like banning the marriage, but then allowing sexual cohabitations or like a short-term relationship. But then say like, you cannot get actually legally married, but then, you know, like living together is totally fine. Or they actually like promote like, yes, you know, like live with local women, for British, like British soldiers, that kind of case. But then, you know, like you cannot legally marry them. So in a way there were always like, always the protections, but then also promotions of the sexual relationships. But I think what Japanese imperialism, what we think it's different, and what we kind of look at it differently, because it is a latecomer. So it started like late 19th century. So in the 20th century, so they already have this, they witnessed like other imperialism, how they dealt with the local population, like the marriage and the intimate relationship, how they dealt with it. So because it's relatively new, from the beginning, I think Japanese imperialism, Japanese metropole center, or they knew they had to manage this kind of intimate relationships.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, yeah. But then the other thing is like Asia, I think it's what makes Japanese imperialism interesting, is because they were conquering nations within the within Asia. So, I mean, the Koreans and Chinese, like Koreans and Taiwanese people in Taiwan, they looked similar, but also they were different. They were from different language. They have different language background, different cultural background, customs, different traditions. And then Korea like had kingdoms, like separate kingdom, completely different from Japan and China. So it's I think because of the closeness to Asia and then sort of geographic closeness that makes enables Japanese population to move to Korea and Taiwan, right? So they can settle into the colonial territories and then become like settlers, colonial settlers. So that's also a different dynamic, I think, having like sending massive population, like middle class or working class population to the colonized territory from the beginning in the 20th century. That's what makes things different than European and U.S. imperialism, rather than it's not like Japan just came out with this idea of intermarriage and promotion of intermarriage, like from the first time in the history of the Earth, right?
Right, right, for sure. No, I think those comparisons, yeah, are certainly very useful and help, as you say, to kind of relativize this experience and understand both the exceptional and particularistic aspects of the Japanese imperial project and those that are helpfully, you know, parallel or like helpfully compared to those elsewhere in the world. I think that's a really great aspect of the book as a whole, actually. You've already mentioned briefly the kind of responses to that project, to that, you know, there's a kind of imperial policy vis-a-vis mixing between Korean and Japanese and other, I guess, Japanese imperial subjects elsewhere too. But there's a, you know, there's a response to that on the ground, which, yeah, as usual in imperial context, I guess, plays out in very complicated ways. So you mentioned briefly that, you know, there's a dimension of masculinity to this, perhaps a kind of effort for men and to assert some kind of parity or, you know, participation in unequal power relations in an imperial context. But more broadly on a gender sort of along gender lines, how did both the promotion, the official promotion of this relationship or intimate relations between Japanese and Korean subjects and the response to it, how did that actually unfold along gendered lines, you know, both in terms of what the authorities were saying and in terms of how, you know, cultural figures were representing it? I guess, bluntly speaking, you know, was it more men from one side being encouraged to partner with women from the other side or vice versa? Could you say something about that?
Right. I think this is like a really interesting point. I think in the colonial Korea, when the promotion or this assimilation policy were like generally promoted in Korea from the beginning, that the intermarriage idea was thrown in because of the royal wedding, which I can talk a little bit later. But then, so the model kind of idea is like, oh, if Koreans marry Japanese, then the Koreans will become Japanese more easily. So the assimilation process could be easier, because you learn Japanese language and customs at home, and then your children will be Japanized children. But the combination of like how, like, is it Japanese man, Korean woman, or Korean man and Japanese woman, I think the Japanese government did not have a clear idea like how gender combination might be. But then the people in the newspapers or where they talk about this, like and then Korean elites, mostly men, male writers, men, male elites, and then public figures and the writers, when they respond and then when they sort of play out this idea, was mostly, not always, but then mostly for Japanese Korean men marrying Japanese women. So it's that's in that sense, it's like opposite of like, you know, like a mainstream Japanese imperial, global imperialism idea, where like British soldiers, British men marrying local Indian women or in the Dutch or British in the Southeast Asia. So it's actually Korean men were thinking about like, oh, let's marry Japanese women. So that's that kind of gender combination, I think, is different. And then that's why in the writings that I talk about, there's kind of like their Korean males' imagination of what Japanese femininity would be. So in that way, having this supportive Japanese woman as your partner, like romantic relationship partner, or you're married, your wife, that sort of validates the also Korean masculinity and also the your status in this imperial hierarchy. So, I mean, for Korean men, like there's more reason to write about this kind of characters, right? The Korean men, you know, living or studying in Japan and then like dating Japanese women, or in Korea, like you meet Japanese women and then immediately because you speak Japanese and then, you know, you have like intimate connection with Japanese women. So in that sense, I think gender representation is unexpected, but then it's still kind of falls within the Korean patriarchy discourse. So I find that very interesting, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, we should say that in terms of the material you're drawing on, whether that's, the kind of Korean cultural output, the novels and also some, I guess, Korea-based films, are produced by and large by male authors or you know, creators, just as we would assume that the government policies from the Japanese side or the Korean government general side are also produced by men. So it's an interesting, I guess, interaction there between differing discourses, at, you know, all focused in a sort of male world and male negotiations of that colonial context, perhaps. Not to the complete exclusion, of course, of female figures, but the actual producers of this stuff, as you say, it's a very patriarchal dynamic throughout. My sort of last question about the overall framing relates to what you were just saying about the kind of response and the participation of Korean authors and so on in this process, whether they were writing in Korean or in Japanese. You have to tread a delicate line. I think you do a great job of tracing both the domination and the dynamics of subjugation that we've already discussed, which are part of the Japanese imperial project, while also documenting the response and the participation, you know, again, albeit under very unequal power dynamics. So just personally for you, you know, as a scholar and as a person documenting this dynamic, were there particular challenges you found when it came to balancing the perspective of, you know, something closer to the historic nationalist narrative about Japan's empire being uniquely oppressive with the idea that there were Korean actors participating in the overall project? How did you kind of tread a line between those two aspects?
excuse me. So I guess I think one thing I had to like tell myself when I'm kind of dealing with this kind of document is that, you know, archival documents, texts, they're not just factual. It's also production of knowledge. So then it has like a stories behind it, like just what you said, like about this, like a colonial elite. The Japanese elites who came up with this kind of policies, they're also all male, right? And so then you have to be aware of like how things function. And also the literary text, film, literature and film, and then I try not to treat them as like the evidence of like historical evidence. Then these literatures are also production of knowledge, and they have more kind of nuanced stories. So, but then the Korean masculinity, I'm not sure if I'm catching your questions still right here.
No, it's entirely, I think you're absolutely are. I guess I think any study of an imperial project is it's challenging to document the role of colonized people in the imperial project without suggesting that they were welcoming it or that everyone was happy, because of course that's not the kind of wouldn't be an accurate representation. So I guess it's how do you give voice to the colonized people without suggesting that they were all very willingly participants in the empire.
Oh, I see. Okay. I think so. I guess I'm running against the previous kind of conversations, right? The previous studies, and what I want to point out is that these colonial elites. So previously there were kind of clear marker of who is 친일, who is this pro Japan, right? Mm-hmm. Activist, and then who are resistant fighters. And then so writers like Lee Kwang-soo is somebody so huge and so famous. And then you read his works in your middle school, high school, in the textbook. But then you are aware that he turned into this pro-Japan person, pro-Japanese. And then he was a promoter for conscriptions and then Korean men participation in the war. Mm. But then the more kind of nuanced in conversation in academia is that, he's not all that just pro-Japan. Right. So he had this nationalist background, but then the way he turned into the pro-Japan was he was actually thinking about Korean nation, the future of Korean nation, and then see this assimilation and then full participation to the Japanese war was the only way for Korean survival. Mm-hmm. So that kind of you give excuse to elites participation. So then, the response to that kind of discourse is it's kind of gray area. Colonial period was gray area. And they had a very hard time making choice. Then also another excuse for this, the collaboration or war participation. So I think my take is that, it's not, of course, it's not clear cut. It's not just single layer. But then when you look at the discourse, so the writings about the intimate relationship, how these Korean men act around Japanese family, Japanese woman, or the other Korean people, Korean women, having relationship with Japanese men, then I think the questions rising from that is more kind of asking about the Korean identity. Mm. So rather than thinking about collaboration or non-collaboration against it, you're truly really thinking about if I speak fluent Japanese, if I mimic the Japanese customs and habits at home, am I going to be treated equally as Japanese? Mm. Am I going to be the same? And is my assimilation successful? Then will I be treated as complete Japanese without any prejudice?
Right. And so, you outlined very clearly the kind of the complexities of both the nuances occurring within Korean society. And as you've said, one important dimension here is a class aspect to those who were involved in working with Japanese authorities and those who were obviously mostly just on the receiving end of what was coming out of the imperial project. But also exactly, as you say there, the attractions in some ways of, the sort of more neutral ideas like modernity and sophistication and these things which, can appear to be things that anyone would want to do despite the fact that they're arriving via an imperial kind of, dynamic of oppression, and how you struggle to as you said make as a colonized subject become equal to the colonizer, although as you I think point out in your analysis that was often never really achieved, even when they were trying their absolute best to be as Japanese as possible. Many of these figures were ultimately still treated, or the characters in their books and so on were also treated still as subordinate. In any case, that kind of broad topic is actually quite often or quite a lot of the focus of chapter one, where you talk about home life and the promotion of certain kinds of relationships, of romantic love, and you know, also new kinds of romantic entanglements under colonial modernity, as well as, you know, how people should live in their home lives and what the stakes of some of that ideas of sort of transforming oneself into a Japanese imperial subject or even a Japanese person were in Korea. But moving beyond that, chapter two deals with a topic you've already mentioned as well, this idea of the promotion of a kind of top-level marriage between Korean and Japanese royals, that is Prince Eun and Princess Pangja. So could you say something more about the sort of idealization of these relationships as promoted from the very top there? How did this particular royal wedding serve as a model for the kind of Japanese-Korean unions that were promoted? And how did that kind of actually interact with what was possible on the ground among Korean and Japanese subjects?
Right. So I think what is interesting about this royal marriage, Eun and the Princess Pangja, Ibangja or Masako, is that the from the beginning, I think Eun was sent to Japan for education. So that was like 1907. So like even before annexation. So when Korea became protectorate in 1905, so the metropole Japanese government was like planning to have Eun educated in this like royal schools, the schools that the Japanese royal kind of families attend. So he was educated there. And then from the early on, like they were saying like he needs to marry Japanese woman. So that's the engagement announcement was in 1916. The actual wedding act happened in 1920. But within that time space, the Korean language newspaper Meiyu, the one and only until 1920s, was like constantly promoting intermarriage, talking about this royal, like expected this royal wedding, and how this this was a model kind of wedding. Model marriage between union between Korean and Japanese. So that was sort of used as a publicity icon in the media. And then if there's this top-down marriage happening, the newspaper and the other kind of elites will start asking, like, is it going to be possible for regular people, right? The common people. And then the newspaper keep raising like issues about difficulties of family registrations and then how the government is going to change it. But at the same time, they also showcase like series of intermarried couples in Korea who are living there already. And then like how this is actually really good for the family, really good for the men, and then really good for the future of the nation, right? So that was kind of a used point for reference for many people. And because of the royal wedding, I think colonial government actually had to process this family registration system. They had to clean up that any Korean person can marry Japanese person legally possible. So they had to move on quickly on that. But then, as I pointed out, like in the book, that actually, you know, it was a little bit random. It was up to really district staff in charge that you could actually register or not register. So until like really late 1930s, the complete Korean-Japanese marriage in the family registration without any loophole or any difficulty, it was not possible like until late 1930s. So actually this kind of, because of double legal system of the Japanese as mainland legal system, and then the Korea has a separate legal system, and then separate like a family registration system. This the merge of the two was never like it never happened. It wasn't ever merged, but then kind of like allowing this like subjects to like move around, that was a challenge for the colonial government and the metropole government. So they were actually kind of slow. You can say they actually slowed the process of enabling people to register the marriage freely. But on the other hand, I'm talking a little bit too much here. But then on the other hand, if you think about the marriage and the weddings, it's actually communal. It's a communal or customary practice. So even without the legal registration, if you're married, you're married. Like your family acknowledge it and community acknowledge it, then you are married, right? So the legality lacked behind, but then there were on the ground, there were people who were having cohabitation in diverse way. So it could be marriage, it could be like short-term arrangement, concubinage, like, you know, like second or third wife, I don't know. But it's there were diverse way of living arrangements at the time.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating kind of way that you chart that these different and often kind of conflicting or at least countervailing regimes of or spheres of relating, right? There's the instincts of a very homogenizing or rationalizing kind of ultra-modern, modernist imperial project, which wants to make sense of everything, wants to formalize everything in a documentary regime. There's the kind of existing, obviously, Korean household registration and so on. I guess there are also customary ideas about the importance of hometown, the importance of origins, and how that is compatible with marriages across the seas to somewhere completely different. And then, as you say, also the kind of variety of understandings that people have about what they're doing compared to what the law is able to accommodate. So it's a really useful, I think, complication of a relationship which we might have assumed otherwise was very one way or very monolithic. But you know, if that's the broad picture of the early kind of period of the empire in Korea, you know, a kind of slightly looser or messier sort of state of affairs, I think the latter part of the book, chapters 3 to 5, you sort of portray a much more tight and stricter kind of approach, which you know, I think many people are familiar with the imperial Japanese history would be familiar with that kind of more wartime homogenizing approach under Kuomintang, right, or Huangminhua, this idea of sort of greater homogenization. So how did this change manifest itself when it came to Korean Japanese unions and expectations around, you know, cultural or ethnic transformation that would happen, you know, as a result of a Korean-Japanese marriage after that 1930s period when things started to get stricter?
I think it's because I'm looking at the literary representation, but the actual number, we have very limited statistic, but actual number, I cannot say like actual, because it is the statistic we know that we have, we know these statistics have gaps. But it generally increased, the intermarriage number generally increased in the 1930s. And then if you go to late 1930s and early 1940s, there's a massive number of, there was a bell sound. Is that okay? Maybe you need to cut that.
That's fine. No, I think it's nice. A little bit of texture. That's great.
Okay. I think it was my computer. So, generally in the late 1930s and the early 1940s, there is a mass number of Korean unmarried men moving to Japan for as either labor recruitment or conscription. And then that, I think, metropole need to track down. So the census becomes more rigorous, and then the number dramatically increase in the late 1930s and the 1940s, just because the census tracking down system became more rigorous. Mm-hmm. And for the literature side, I think we do see more more frequent appearance of intermarriage or romance literature from the late 1930s and the early 1940s. That's one reason is because of the venue limitations and the censorship regime. So after 1935, a Korean proletarian literature group was disbanded, and it wasn't possible to write about anything against the empire, against the Japanese imperialism anyway. And so I think the topic also was considered rather kind of empire friendly, so it definitely could avoid certain censorship, right? So I think that's why this kind of literature number or frequency of the appearance of this literature in these venues kind of increased in the late 1930s. That doesn't mean that there was no population of intermarriage before, or there's a minimum population of intermarried people, and then late 1930s all of a sudden intermarriage couples number has tripled or quadrupled. That's why the literature has increased. So these are kind of separate things that I want to acknowledge. But then I think one thing maybe for example, I can say Yosok's my chapter in the Yosok, I talk about the Yosok's short stories written in Japanese, Ajami no Sho. But the venue itself, where Ajami no Sho was published, is a magazine titled 국민문학 or 국민문학고. It's a national literature. So it's the magazine was launched to in compliance of the Kominka, right? So it's this Korean writers group had to come up with a new kind of literary magazine, literary journal that's in line with the Japanese imperialism. And then in the initial inaugural issue, Yosok wrote about this Korean-Japanese couple living in Seoul. So in that sense, this kind of Kominka and the heightened sense of the Naesonilje brought more kind of more appearance of the literature. But at the same time, when you really read the story closely, then you can see there's all kinds of agonies about the couple, intermarried couple, living in kind of urbanized modern society, but at the same time, questioning about the identity, Koreanness and Japaneseness. And so it's in a way that there's a limit of this venue and the limit of language, and the readership brought certain topics to be published, but within that venue, within that publication, you still have this all sort of questions that certainly does not just comply with imperial logic.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that kind of goes outside the bounds of the official portrayal of harmonious, kind of problem-free union, I guess. And you bring in literature. We haven't had much chance to talk in detail about lots of the culturally rich literary examples you have. I mean, that can be something that listeners get the book to look into themselves. But you bring in literature that both deals head-on, I guess, directly with Korean-Japanese romantic relationships and so on, where that's the main topic or the main theme of the work, and also works that kind of just happen to have characters in them who are very, kind of probably Korean-Japanese couples or and so on. And I think you bring out there some of those ambiguities really that exist where you're watching a film or reading a book where you think that the characters are probably somebody is Korean or someone is Japanese, but even in the actual writing, it's not always totally clear because of what you also highlight about the way people change their names, the way people spoke languages often very fluently. Korean people again, especially elites, spoke extremely good Japanese by many of them native level Japanese by this later period. And so those ambiguities are very, very interesting, very rich. But I wonder if we might just say something about one particular author whom you've already mentioned there, Iyosok, because he, I guess, is an example of what you mentioned at the beginning about someone who is known. You know, people are aware of him in contemporary Korea, but maybe they're not aware of exactly quite the detail of his works that you bring out here. So could you say a bit more about Iyosok and his kind of what his work sort of reveals about the period compared to how he is perceived in Korea today?
Right. Iyosok is generally perceived in Korea as like somebody who wrote nostalgic landscape or rural landscapes, right? Who has this nostalgia of hometown and the rural landscape. But this actually is, if you read like his entire work, he's like very kind of urbanized modern modern person, like a modern boy kind of person. And he enjoys like drinking coffee, and he talks about like, I want, you know, enjoying Christmas trees, going to ski in the winter, and then he loves butter, all kind of this so foreign things. It's like completely opposite of this rural landscape stuff. And then he's, because I think Dazaimi no Shou is not well known because it was written in Japanese. And so some of his work that were written in Japanese were not in this kind of full collection of his work, like Chonjip kind of like all, you know, like writing. So until it's like late 90s, 2000s, that was like translated, the Japanese language writings were translated into Korean. So this piece, one piece that I analyze here, and there's Ajami no Shou, the story of Tissot. It is interesting, I think, in a way that shows all this kind of ambiguities, and then between Koreanness, what is supposed to be Koreanness, and what is supposed to be Japaneseness. And the Iyosok is a person who actually he never studied in Japan, so he studied in Korea, but then by the time, you know, he was getting education, there were enough infrastructure that you become fluently in Japanese from the middle school, high school. And then he went to like a Gyeongseong Keijo, the Imperial University in English literature. So he studied, you know, with other Japanese colonial Japanese settlers, and then some Koreans in that university. So mainly like studying in Japanese, right? So anyway, so this kind of brings into how Koreanness and the Japaneseness can be it's a more flex. It has this kind of flexible boundaries. So what I wanted to point out is he's kind of person who actually believes this assimilation or turning into different race or ethnicity, it can be very easy. And in the, because it's a writing, it's different from the movies that I can talk about maybe a little bit later. But then in your writing, like you can create this illusion that that one, this character now speaks complete Japanese, and then kind of you can pass completely as Japanese, right? Then also vice versa, like this Japanese woman, if you wear Korean dress and then walk in this like palace park, the formerly the palace, but then it's a public park, then if you walk around there like with your like husband looking man, then you can pass as Korean, right? So he brings in, I think, interesting points about at the time, what is the reference of passing, what cannot pass, and then also how that's also related to class issue. It's only for a certain class that who can maintain this kind of certain look and certain speech, and then certain like attitude like that you carry with your body. Can have this access to passing.
Yeah, well, I guess those nuances, as you say, you do trace very well as they're represented in written literature vis-a-vis film. Unfortunately, I think we may not have time to delve so deeply into the film side, but I would, of course, highlight that for listeners, because it's an extremely interesting comparison there, as you say, between what you can get away with, or what you know, how characters appear when they're on film visually, and also when you hear accents in films that have spoken soundtracks and so on. That's a really compelling part of the latter part of the book here. And you then close out with an epilogue that I guess reflects somewhat on the kind of post-colonial status and contemporary relevance of this intimacy and imperial romance in Korea's navigation of its current position vis-a-vis Japan and the world, including, you know, making reference to, I guess, works which listeners may be familiar with, more recent cultural output, including Agashi, right, the Handmaiden, some very popular international portrayals of some of these ambiguities too. But I think, you know, we've had a pretty good run through a lot of the book, so I don't want to take up any more of your time, which you've very generously given us today. But before we do go, I'll ask you perhaps if you could say a bit more about what you're kind of currently working on, what kind of project has followed on from the Imperial Romance one.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much for that kind of wrapping up things. So one, I guess, like one self-publicity is that because I couldn't put everything in the epilogue about, and also about the cinema part in the book, I published a separate article on the only just focusing on the cinema part of the sort of the colonial intimacy and also post-colonial, so post-liberation representation of colonial intimacy. So you can look up my article, listeners.
Great. What's the title of that?
Transwar. I'm forgetting my own title. Transwar. Okay, Transwar: Continuities of Colonial Intimacy.
Gotcha.
Korean-Japanese relationship in Korean cinema, 1940s to 1960. That's perfect. The title.
Perfect. Yes.
And after the book was done. So I've been working on the second book project for quite a long time, which more focus on intimacy, but as like and represented in popular literature. Mm-hmm. So I'm still interested in like cultural production, the making of the cultural production, and the kind of as a part of the knowledge production, and sort of maybe Foucauldian way of like tracing the genealogy. And so how I'm looking at how popular literature writings use like a romantic interest, like a romantic relationship and the intimate relationship as the like main mechanism of the driving power of this popular literature. So it's kind of considered as the 통속 소설, or like kind of more secondary novel more vulgar cultural kind of publications. And so from the colonial era to up to like maybe 1960s. And also there are I look at more Cold War, like women's writings and women's magazines in the 50s and 60s. I have some like, side projects, like looking into like representation of Asia in the Cold War by this kind of Korean writers, or the film kind of way of the co-production. I'm looking at co-production of Korea and Hong Kong, and then Korea and Japan. That's kind of side projects, though.
Excellent. Well, that sounds like a really great continuation of the insights that we gained from this book about the earlier period. So I'm sure we'll look forward a lot to seeing those kind of come to fruition, if you like. But in any case, Sue, thank you so much again for your time today. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was great talking to you too.
And listeners, great as ever to have you listening. You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network, and it will be with you again very soon. Goodbye.